I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to dissect the just-completed session of the Indiana General Assembly. We'll talk about what happened, what didn't happen, who got helped, and who got hurt. We'll discuss both the high-profile issues and the quiet developments that might have slipped by with little notice. My guests are Shana Cavazos of Chalkbeat, Indiana, Rachel Hoffmeyer of thestatehousefile.com, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits at WFYI.org, Facebook is No Limits WFYI, Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about the just-completed 2017 session of the Indiana General Assembly, taking apart what happened, what didn't happen, who won and who lost during that session. But before we get into that discussion, I would like to remind everyone that if you like discussions such as this one, where we try to generate light rather than heat and make sure that it is the wisest voice and not the loudest voice that prevails, I would ask you as a personal favor to make a contribution to WFYI. You can do so by going to the website, wfyi.org/give. You also can call us at 1-800-233-0020. Operators are ready to take your call right now. My guests are John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute, Shana Cavazos of Chalkbeat, Indiana, and Rachel Hoffmeyer of thestatehousefile.com. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks for having us.
It's good to have you here. Should say to our listeners, if you want to join this conversation about what happened in the legislature, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881, sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, finding us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or on Twitter at WFYI. And then the last bit of business I need to take care of here is doing what is probably an obvious disclosure, but Rachel and I work together at thestatehousefile.com. Don't want to hold anything back. So let's start first, and I'm going to start with Shana on this one. What was the biggest, most important thing that happened, would you say, out of this session?
That's actually pretty tough because for a session that didn't, get messaged as being all about education, it still kind of was. I'd say the big few would be we've got an ISTEP replacement test. Lawmakers approved a proposal to have the governor appoint rather than elect the state superintendent of public instruction. And we have an expanded preschool pilot program. So those were just a couple big ones, but quite honestly, that's not even it.
John, how about you?
I will second that. I think it's important for all of us to remember that if Indiana were a business, education would be our actual business. That's what our product would be, because we spend two-thirds of our state budget on education from kindergarten through college. And so I think Shana's exactly right about that being the major area where accomplishment occurred for a lot of reasons. But I also will point out that the only thing that the legislature has to do this past session was to pass a new two-year budget, mm-hmm. which they did. It's not a lot different, but it's got several wrinkles in it. It spends about $32 billion in state money over the next 2 years, an astounding amount of money when you think about it. It should leave a surplus, assuming that the economy doesn't go south mm-hmm. between now and the end of the next two fiscal years. And it should ensure that the state's able to meet its needs. But it also is a list of the priorities for the state of Indiana, and education is atop that.
Rachel, I'll refine the question ever so slightly for you. What was, would you say, the most interesting thing that came out of this session of the legislature?
I think the discussion that's going to have to take place over the next probably couple of years over the alcohol laws is one that will capture attention across the state. They ended up having it to scramble a bit at the last minute when they discovered that Ricker's convenience stores had obtained an alcohol license that allowed them to sell cold carryout beer because they had been defined as a restaurant. They had added some tables and started serving made-to-order Mexican food, and in the process were able to get a restaurant license from the ATC. And that has sort of put everybody on their toes in a way where I think in the past lawmakers have kind of talked about alcohol laws, but nothing really goes much of anywhere. And now, you know, they're really faced with, okay, we've got these issues. How are we going to fix them for the future?
Every time I was over at the State House and I'd be walking around the halls out there and talking primarily to lobbyists and even to a few of the legislators, I would sort of ask it, is it my imagination or has this been a pretty quiet session, particularly after the last few where, you know, we'd had Right to Work and then the war over proposed constitutional amendment banning same-sex unions and then the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and then sort of RFRA 2 and all of that. What was that a deliberate? Did your reporting say that that was kind of a deliberate choice, that the legislators really wanted to lower the volume when it came to this session?
Well, I believe Governor Holcomb really set the agenda this year. You know, when he came out and said, these are my goals, they were based primarily on, you know, business, education, road funding, and getting a budget. You know, when you look at his list of what he's interested in, you know, he's facing more of the fiscal issues, and you know, that had to have set tone for the rest of the legislature to a degree as well.
We've gotten a Facebook message from a listener named Janet, and if you want to join the conversation, you can do what Janet did and reach out to us via Facebook at No Limits WFYI. You can find us on Twitter at WFYI. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can call us at 866-476-3881. Janet writes, how much money in the state budget goes to charter schools and vouchers compared to traditional public schools? Shana, I think that one's got your name written all over it.
So that's a good question. It kind of gets at a bit of maybe mild controversy during the budget debate this year. First off, it's hard to know exactly what that is. They don't give you three distinct numbers in the budget, which definitely some lawmakers and educators and lobbyists have really called for. In an early version of the budget, actually, vouchers were pulled out as a line item, but then that was taken back out during the final version. So I do know, though, that for the state's voucher program, over the next 2 years, they'll spend somewhere around $157 million. And the charter versus traditional public school question is a lot harder to get at because charter schools are kind of built into the funding formula like other schools. So you'd have to kind of go school by school through the, you know, many pages of funding totals to kind of pick that out if you wanted to add them. So I don't really know a total answer, but I do know that I believe the education budget fully is somewhere around $14 billion. And, you know, a portion of that is charter schools. It's hard to be more specific than that without diving into data.
Yeah, John, I was going to go to you next. What's the, shall we say, first the surface argument for that lack of transparency? And then what's the real argument?
Okay. I'll get to that in just a second. I wanted to add just a little bit to what Shana was saying. That $14 billion is over the two-year period. Mm-hmm. So the annual budget is about $7 billion a year for education K-12. And as you said, about $150 to $160 million of that is for vouchers. And it is hard to tell. You have to basically calculate the number of students in charter schools, but the number of students in charter schools versus those in traditional public schools is fairly small.
Right.
So the direct answer to Janet's question is we don't know exactly how much of that education money goes into charter schools or to vouchers, but overall it's a relatively small amount of money. And as to the question about whether vouchers should be a separate line item or not, it was the Senate that added that provision to the House bill. And the argument made by Senator Kenley was that there should be transparency, that we should know how much money is going into the voucher program because it does directly affect the amount of money that goes into public schools otherwise. And so he made a transparency argument, which is really kind of the surface and the subsurface answer. Senator Kenley was arguing for having that out there transparently, and I would argue that he's correct about that. The House, on the other hand, likes it where it is because it is hard to tell just how much money is going into vouchers the voucher program on an annual basis.
And what is their argument, though, for obscuring that?
Their argument is that it's all part of education.
Well, and there, I think there was some concern, too. And I forget exactly who said it, but within the leadership, you know, that if this was identified and pulled out specifically, that it would be easier to make cuts to it. I don't know whether that actually would end up being true or not, but that was part of the rationale given for why it was edited out.
But Rachel or John, either one of you, couldn't that argument be applied to just about any part of the budget?
Yes. The answer is yes.
Okay.
And I think Shane is right, but I think what the House was saying is, it might be harder to justify the expenditure on vouchers, too. And they don't want to have to make that argument because Indiana, as far as I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, but Indiana spends more on a voucher program than any other state in the country. Is that correct?
Dollar for dollar, I just don't know. But, I mean, as far as percentage of students, definitely one of the largest in the country.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've been involved with a voucher program from nearly the beginning, and we're very large. We're very heavily invested in that. But I think there are some who in the House who are concerned that it would become a target. If you pull that number out and say we spend X amount of money on vouchers, then it becomes a target for opponents.
Rachel, the other big change when it came to education was one you mentioned earlier, which is that the state superintendent of public instruction going forward will be an appointed rather than an elected office, which seemed to be a high priority for the governor and the legislators. Was it a big priority for anybody outside the walls of the state house?
Well, I think that this was of certain interest to especially education groups, of course. But there is a bit of an issue with the lawmakers feeling concern that after what happened with Governor Mike Pence, who is obviously a Republican, and then former superintendent Glenda Ritz, who is a Democrat, repeatedly going head to head, that there was need for the process to go smoothly within inside the state house walls and then, you know, trickle out to the schools as well, that it would be better if everybody was on the same team. So the lawmakers felt that it was an important decision to go ahead and make that change. And if you're going to make a change like that, the timing is fairly good since, you know, the people in the state house right now are Republican controlled. We have Republican statewide offices and they're all held by Republicans, and including this current superintendent of public instruction.
And this is something that has been discussed for a long time in the General Assembly, too. I remember Governor Bayh making that suggestion of the legislature.
A similar dynamic, though, because Dean Evans was driving
that's
crazy
right
at the time.
Right. And then between Dean Evans and Glenda Ritz, you had a period of relative stability, even though you had sometimes a split between the parties. You had, you know, superintendents and administrations that worked fairly well together. I think that the argument can be made that everybody already thinks that the governor's office controls education policy in the state of Indiana, so why shouldn't that person have the ability to appoint that person? I think that's a decent argument. And we also have seen the legislature remove the clerk of the courts from an elected office in recent years. And there was a person who ran for Secretary of State several years ago who said, first thing I'll do is advocate eliminating this office. So there's some thought that these ministerial offices should be appointed rather than elected anyway. Electoral purists and people who think that elections should matter at all levels will disagree with that. But I think that was kind of the thinking behind this.
Shana, what's the practical effect going to be of this change, though?
Well, that's really hard to know. I mean, it definitely depends on the political environment. A lot of people said that this would remove politics from education. But when you have, you know, I mean, a governor who's elected in a party and legislators elected in a party, then appointing your education officials, I mean, I don't see how it's possible to ever completely remove that. If they're hoping to reduce friction, I'm sure it's possible that that would happen. I do know, though, that one concern was that by removing the election process for the superintendent was that you might eliminate kind of an independent voice for education. Now, lawmakers would be the first to tell you that that's not part of Indiana's state constitution, that the legislature and the governor are, you know, charged with setting education policy. But I know there are a lot of people out there, particularly educators, who were supporters of Glenda Ritz and I'm sure others, who would really like to see that independent kind of education-focused expertise remain.
Well, as we pointed out, though, as long as then we're getting a little bit tight on time here, so I'll ask for very quick answers. What is the likelihood, as long as 2/3 of the state's budget is going to be spent on education, that we're going to get politics out of education discussions?
It's impossible. The only thing you can do is to hope to manage it, and that's up to the public to make its desires felt, and this eliminates one avenue for that.
Rachel and Shana, any disagreement there?
No,
it's going to be part of it. We are talking about the just completed 2017 session of the Indiana General Assembly on new limits today. My guests are John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute, Shana Cavazos of Chalkbeat Indiana, and Rachel Hoffmeyer of the StateHouseFile.com. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're wrapping up the 2017 session of the Indiana General Assembly, talking about what happened, what didn't happen, who won and who lost. My guests are John Ketzenberger, the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute, and upon occasion, my guest host here, Shana Cavazos of Chalkbeat, Indiana, and my colleague at the StateHouseFile.com, Rachel Hoffmeyer, who's the executive editor there. We've gotten an email question from our regular listener named Jerry. If you want to join this conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can send us a note via email, as Jerry did, at nolimits@wfyi.org. Jerry writes, is one of today's panelists yet prepared openly to question the fundamental wisdom of the citizens' legislature myth, by dint of which refusal to pay legislators a living wage is considered to serve the public good? To some of us more dim-witted Hoosiers, the situation appears inherently to encourage perpetual amateurism, shallow thinking, and even actual corruption. Jerry is known for his passionate question, shall we say. John, I'll let you have a crack
dint,
at that.
By dint of,
yeah.
I guess we know where Jerry stands on that issue. You know, I think it's an interesting thought, though. I'm of two minds. I equate that to term limits. We often hear this notion that they ought to have term limits as well. And I would guess that Jerry's not very fond of that, and I'm not either. I think term limits are constituted by elections, even with districts that are somewhat advantageous to one party. When you do have term limits, you're churning the legislature, and the power moves out into the halls, basically. The institutional memory and the power becomes resident in the halls. And I think that's some of the same concern. Is Indiana ready for a full-time legislature? I don't think so. But I think it's worthy of thinking about, and we won't see any thinking about a full-time legislature. But I think that it would allow the members to spend their time, more time with issues than they currently are able to spend. The system that we have now is basically a sprint, even in a, quote, long session. The time in between sessions is sometimes productively used, but we've already talked about the alcohol laws and how seriously will they get reviewed during the interim between this session and the next one. So I have some sympathy for Jerry's perspective. I think there is some merit to the argument, but I don't think that the legislative leadership is anywhere close to the mindset that they would consider something like that.
Rachel, how much of that is, though, the consideration that, you know, the perception that I'm trying to frame this question without seeming to take, you know, the argument that often is heard when you talk about this conversion in other states is that these legislators just want to give themselves a pay raise or to eliminate. So is it the political consideration, the fact that no one wants to vote for this and then turn around and have to run on it 2 years or 4 years later, the thing that really kills it?
I think repeatedly you see at the State House where sometimes change is difficult to have happen, even when people are on the same page. And as we were previously talking about the superintendent of public instruction, that's been an issue that's been discussed for decades. And it's just now going to be taking effect that the position's going to be appointed. So to see change like that move through the State House, I would also imagine that you would probably have to see the discussion happen for quite a while before it would move. You do hear a variety of arguments at the State House. Some people would say that if you were going to move toward a full-time legislature, perhaps we'd be able to widen the demographics of the legislators, because you know, if you are a woman who wants to have children, you're going to have to find a way to be at the State House, you know, 4 months out of the year, and you're also going to have to find a way to figure out how to pay the bills the rest of the year, which is why I think we tend to see a legislature that tends to have more retired people taking part in the process, or perhaps, you know, lawyers who can have more of a flexible place. And then the opposite side is that some people would argue that if you have a part-time legislature, it gives your lawmakers a chance to be out in the public more often and less likely to be spending their time with lobbyists.
And Shana, I want to pick up on the last point of Jerry's question, too, to do the corruption part. We have seen examples of companies, interests that do business with the state actually hiring lawmakers to go to work for them. Is that problematic, or is that something in this sort of setup that we just have to deal with?
I think that's a situation that's much bigger than Indiana. I know that lawmakers, you know, everywhere and critics everywhere are talking about whether that's appropriate. And quite honestly, I think it's a little above my pay grade to take a particular stance. But I know that there are many people who feel strongly both ways.
Well, and I'll just add on to that just a little bit and say that if you had a full-time legislature, then it would be pretty easy to say you can't go to work for, you know, this particular cause. And now with the part-time legislature, it's hard to argue against somebody having a chance to make a living, even as problematic as it can be, as fraught with conflicts as that can be. So I think that if you had a full-time legislature, it wouldn't be as big an issue. But when you've got a part-time legislature, it's hard to deny somebody an opportunity to make a living, even in those kinds of conditions.
And we'll move on from this in a second, but we're also dealing with something, at least in the state's history, that's a relative anomaly, and that is that every statewide office holder is Republican. There are supermajorities in both chambers. I want to talk about the supermajority piece of this, because one of the things that prompted good government advocates to go into overdrive was the situation with Eric Turner a few years ago, where he honored, to the best, as far as anyone could see, the letter of the law, in that he didn't vote on any of the legislation affecting his private business interests. But in caucus, apparently, he was advocating for those interests. How dangerous is it that so many of the decisions now with this state government don't have to take place out in the open? I'll start with Shana on that one.
You know, as a journalist, obviously, I feel like the free flow of information and transparency are very important. So I would say that's probably pretty dangerous in the long run. I know that lawmakers spend quite a bit of time in caucus, particularly when there are major issues to be decided. And, you know, on the floor, all you kind of see then are bills being skipped or, you know, passed. And you never really know why. I wish, you know, I've heard from other journalists who've been here longer than I have that when the government, or rather when the legislature was more split evenly along party lines, that there was quite a bit of conversation that had to happen in the open. And I have a hard time believing that that's not better for Indiana.
Yeah, I agree that the concentration of power in one side versus the other certainly makes it difficult and makes it easier for coordination among the groups. I'm not a big fan of using the caucus. And just so listeners are clear, the caucus is when the groups in the House, all the Republicans or all the Democrats, gather and they meet in private.
And the Republicans need a much larger room for their caucuses.
They do. They use ways and means these days, and it's barely big enough for them.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's when they can talk in private. And you know, I don't think I think the problems can exist, and we don't know exactly what former Representative Turner was saying, but the fact is we know, and it's because it made some of his fellow caucus members uncomfortable, and they didn't like that. So there's a certain amount of self-policing, but I do think, you know, sunlight in these kinds of situations is always better for public confidence.
Gotten an email question from a listener named Shelby. If you want to reach out to us via email, you can do so by sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Shelby writes, House Minority Leader Scott Piloth and Senate Minority Leader Tim Lannon both highlighted what they would have done differently this session. What is the likelihood that we could see issues like minimum wage, hate crimes, redistricting, and civil rights come into play again in the 2018 session? Any chance they'll go further than they did in the 2017 session? Rachel, I'll start with you on that one.
Sure. Well, with hate crimes, that bill has come back year after year, and there seems likelihood that the bill will probably be authored by somebody and come back again next year. But, you know, you see this interesting dynamic that happens where, for example, the Senate Democrats attempted to amend the bill into the budget because there's a rule that says anything can be amended into the budget. And since the legislation hadn't progressed, and Senator Greg Taylor was asking Senator Kinley if he would join him as a co-author next year. And Senator Kinley said no. You know, he's one of the most powerful Republicans at the State House. So that's going to be coming back. But as for its future, I'm not certain. As for redistricting reform, you know, the advocates for that are pretty passionate. But there's another one that I would have loved to have been inside caucus to know, you know, a little bit more about what was going on behind the scenes. The answer that we were given for why the bill didn't receive a vote in committee was that the lawmakers wanted more time to work on the bill. But that was after a summer study committee had taken time to draft a plan for a nonpartisan commission. So, you know, I know if certain advocates have their way, we'll certainly be hearing about it for a while.
We've gotten a similar question on hate crimes via Facebook from a listener named Andrea. And if you want to find us on Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. Andrea says, when will Indiana get a hate crimes law? We are one of five states without them. How does this happen? Why do you think it is not a priority of legislators? John?
Well, how it happens is that you know, the majority is held by Republicans, and the majority of the Republicans don't believe that Indiana needs that particular enhancement, that there are laws already in place that can be utilized. There is a lot of disagreement about that, and we are an exception to the rule, but there hasn't been a lot of momentum either among the Republicans in the General Assembly or among officialdom, meaning prosecutors and sorts of folks like that, to make that, you know, to change their minds on that.
We have seen, too, interesting dynamic, and we've alluded to it without really pulling it out, the fact that there were differences between the House version and the Senate version, for example, on the voucher question. We saw it on how they approach the road funding, all of that. How much of this legislative session was kind of a quiet struggle for predominance between the two chambers? John.
That's always the most fascinating question, especially when you have a supermajority in one party. Senator Long and Speaker Bosma often have different views personally, but they also have to reflect the views of their individual or their overall caucuses. I think that Senator Long has a more split caucus, and there are a large number of more conservative members in the Senate who hold a lot of sway, and so you tend to see some of that expressed in what happens between the House and the Senate. But Speaker Bosma has his own challenges within his caucus, and he has to make judgments based on what he thinks will fly within those caucuses. And so even though they're all on the same, quote, team, they have, a lot of different position players, if you will. And, some of those position players command or demand more attention than others. And that's where you get friction between the House and the Senate.
Who won most of the arguments, though, this session, Shana?
Oh, I don't know, but I will say, to add to what John said, a really good example of how that plays out was through preschool. Mm-hmm. The Senate tends to be particularly skeptical over the investment. A big part of that is Senator Luke Kenley, as Rachel mentioned earlier. He exerts a lot of influence because he helps write the budget. Whereas the House stated from the beginning that they were very open to and supportive of a bigger increase. So, I mean, that's, something we've seen play out in Indiana for a few years as they've explored early education. But it's a good example of how the Senate and the House are, can really differ over an issue, even within the Republican, led state House.
Do you see that, Rachel, that friction decreasing or increasing the longer these supermajorities are in play?
I think the longer the supermajorities are in play, the more you'll see it increase, because you're not having to fight with the other party. You're having to fight within your own party and talk about things within, as we mentioned, caucus, another opportunity for yet more friction to occur when perhaps they're speaking a little bit more openly. You see things where at the beginning of the legislative session, a bill had been filed by a House member that would have been a total abortion ban, and Speaker Brian Bosma was getting kind of tired about answering questions from the media because he wanted to focus on roads.
We are talking today on No Limits about the 2017 session of the Indiana General Assembly. My guests are John Ketzenberger, the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute, Shana Cavazos of Chalkbeat, Indiana, and Rachel Hoffmeyer of the StateHouseFile.com. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're dissecting the 2017 session of the Indiana General Assembly today on No Limits. My guests are John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute, Shana Cavazos of Chalkbeat, Indiana, and my colleague Rachel Hoffmeyer with thestatehousefile.com, where she's the executive editor. We have a question via Facebook from a listener named Jen, and if you want to join the conversation here, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or doing what Jen did, you can find us on Facebook at nolimits@WFYI. Jen writes, House Bill 1127 nullified all regulations imposed in Indiana by the United States Environmental Protection Agency. This bill never made it out of committee. I am frustrated by bills like this that are created by representatives. I feel the only reason they do it is to make a promise to their constituents, and when it doesn't make it out of committee, they blame the system, saying, see, I kept my promise, but I couldn't do anything about it because of the system, other elected officials. How much time and energy is wasted because of bills like this? John, I'll throw that to you since.
Well, Jen defined that very accurately. There are a lot of bills that are introduced by a lot of legislators who don't anticipate that they will go anywhere. They're either making a statement or fulfilling a promise to a constituent. It's just part of the process. And, you know, I understand Jen's frustration. But really, the only time that gets wasted is by the poor folks who have to draft the legislation that's clearly going nowhere, and then by whomever in the Speaker's office has read it and assigned it to a committee, and then told the chairman not to do anything with that bill.
I have to advance this next question, though, with a disclosure for. 5.5 years or so, I was the executive director of the Indiana Civil Liberties Union. I want to take the premise of Jen's question a little further than that, though, because I remember from that experience there are measures that get moved through the legislature that lawmakers know are not going to stand up to a legal challenge.
Oh, yeah, that still happens.
And they kick it down. In fact, one of my experiences there was running into legislators who voted for the measure, and they were, among themselves, far away from microphones and cameras, referring to it as the ICLU Appropriations Act of that particular legislative session. In that case, there is waste built into the process, though, because it gets moved. You chew up the court's time. There are legal fees on the back end when the state loses that the state has to pay. How damaging is that to the process, and I think to the real spirit of Jen's question here, which is, what does this do to citizens' faith in their government?
We have seen an era, and we still see bills that have been enacted that are almost immediately struck down by the courts. And, you know, I can see the point that can have a corrosive effect on public confidence. But it's not like it's a secret. Mm-hmm. These are things that are done pretty much, out in the open. And the reason the courts exist are to weigh in on the constitutionality of a particular law or set of laws that are enacted by the state. So the system is functioning. Whether it's functioning efficiently is a different question. And I can see where Jen would worry about whether it's functioning efficiently and how much waste is involved in this, quote unquote, and two, how it might shake the confidence of people who are watching it. But you could also take heart in the fact that the system is working, that there is a check on the legislative overreach, and that laws that are deemed unconstitutional then don't go into effect.
Got an email question from a listener named Chris. And again, if you want to reach out to us via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Chris writes, in his veto message on legislation allowing fees for certain information document requests, Governor Holcomb said that he doesn't want to put burdensome obstacles before people seeking government records. But then in the budget, he put language that would shield drug manufacturers who sell Indiana medicines used for executions. Does he support transparency or not? Shana, I'm going to throw that one to you first, but I'd like to hear everybody's thoughts on it.
Those things definitely could be seen as being in conflict. However, I was a little surprised to see that Governor Holcomb vetoed the public record search legislation. I'm not sure that his predecessor would have done the same thing. So I think, certainly somebody who interacts with public records all the time and hopes that they remain easy, cheap, and accessible, I think that does speak to a level of transparency that he is supportive of. But, the budget, as Rachel mentioned, is a place where a lot of stuff can get by, and I don't know, I'm not sure exactly what the motivation was for including that lethal injection language and whether that's in direct conflict in his mind.
Rachel, how transparent has this administration been?
Well, they've been working towards making sure that people stay in the loop and reaching out to the media in a positive manner. I know that earlier today, Governor Holcomb held a press conference in which he answered some questions about the death penalty addition to the budget. And at that time, he said that he feels like, as the governor, it's his duty to he's been placed in charge of these executions and that he has to find a way to administer it. And if anyone's been following what's been happening in Arkansas, where they're in a race against the clock to execute prisoners before a drug expires, a lawsuit has sprung out of that entire process with a pharmaceutical company not wanting their drug to be used for fear of backlash, and in part for fear of backlash. And I think it's interesting that that's happening at the same time that this is happening, and that they're seeking a way for there to be some sort of protections for the pharmaceutical companies. I think that from his statements today, the governor is trying to say, you know, these are different issues, and that he's just trying to administer his job as someone who has to administer, you know, the process for the death penalty.
John.
I don't want to draw too much from either one of these situations, but I do think that as inelegant as the solution in the budget is, and it is a clunky attempt to address the problems raised by the Arkansas situation, I don't think that's reflective of the governor's lack of transparency, as the questioner might suggest. I think that you get more of an idea about his approach to government from his veto and his desire to ensure that there wasn't an add-on cost. And his theory is basically those records are developed by public employees for public use, and adding an extra layer of cost or difficulty in obtaining them is improper. And I think that's more reflective of his personal view than trying to fix that situation that Rachel described.
Eric Holcomb had his first session as governor, and in fact, his first session really as an elected official ever. Assessments, what could we take from this session about, you know, what the Holcomb governorship, Holcomb administration is going to be like over the next few years? What were some of the indicators? I'm going to start with Rachel on that one.
Sure. I think the Holcomb administration should be pretty pleased with how everything shook out in their first year. I know when the Senate revealed their plan, we talked about pre-K earlier, when the Senate revealed their plan and the majority of the money that the governor's office had requested and received support from House Republicans was gone, I was wondering, well, who's going to win out on this one? This could get very interesting. And when you take a look at the plan that Holcomb set forth, he got the majority of what he asked for by far. He wanted funding for a new drug czar to help create a comprehensive strategic plan for combating the drug problem in Indiana. He wanted raises for police officers. He wanted more money for his economic plans for a fourth port and direct flights. And there were a variety of issues that were all very expensive that he was able to get, despite, you know, everybody having their own wants and desires for the budget. So the only one of the major things that was missing was a complete tax exemption for military pensions. But, you know, the military group spoke up and said they wanted something different. So, you know, there's still military provisions in the budget. So I think that the Holcomb team should be pretty pleased and looking forward to a future if things continue to go as well as that did.
Shana, do you agree that he had a pretty effective first session? And if so, what made him effective?
Well, I think efficacy is a slightly different question. I mean, certainly, you know, his agenda certainly played out positively, as Rachel mentioned. I think it remains to be seen exactly how effective that'll be as he tries to implement it. You know, we just don't know yet because he's just only received, as he kind of put it this morning, the tools with which he can now act. So I think there's still a lot left to observe. But, you know, again, I also think that at least just when it comes to education, he crossed off everything on his list, aside from a snafu with the appointment date for the state superintendent being later than he had lobbied for. But, you know, also I don't know that anything on that agenda was particularly bold or very likely to fail. So, I mean, you kind of have to measure against what was the expectation he set. And if you set goals that you think you can accomplish and then you accomplish them, that's different than putting forward really bold, unusual ideas that you know, might not really easily go through as, you know, pre-K and the superintendent did, things that we already know House Republican leaders supported and senators as well.
I'm going to reframe it slightly for you, John. By effective, I guess I meant he did get much of his package through the legislature. Whether he implements it effectively, I get it's is a separate question. But it was a different dynamic than we saw with either with Mike Pence and, frankly, even for with Mitch Daniels. The process between the governor's office and the legislative branch seemed to be far less adversarial this time around. What accounted for that?
I think you can point to two things readily. One, don't forget that Eric Holcomb was the state Republican chairman. And as such, it was his responsibility to know all of these people, and he helped many of these people in their elections. And so he had a very direct relationship with a lot of people in the General Assembly that other governors haven't had in recent years. And two, I think it was really his priority to have good relationship with the legislature. And he appointed a ready team, an experienced team, and they worked very closely from the get-go, from the moment the election was over until the session started, and then all through the session, to understand what the legislature's temperature was, to clearly enunciate what the governor's priorities were, where there could be movement. And I think that that is different than we've seen. Certainly since Governor Pence was in office, he didn't seem to place as much of a priority on that. And I think Governor Daniels had a much more aggressive style personally and through his advocates in the General Assembly. And so you saw a collaborative effort, and you saw somebody who was willing to work with the legislature. And I think they responded by really giving him everything meaningful that he could want. And I think that stands in stark contrast. I mean, look, Governor Pence was able to win a lot of success from the legislature, but it was kind of grudging from the legislature's point of view. Governor Daniels had a fair amount of success, but, you know, he was very aggressive and he had an aggressive response, and it was more of a, you know, a clashing style that ended up where it did at the end of the session. This has been much more collaborative, and I think the legislature and the legislative leaders appreciate that.
We're getting really close on time. What was the most important issue that the legislature didn't deal with this time? Everyone's looking away from me right now and avoiding eye contact. Shana.
I'll go. I think there was a lot of call for more movement on school funding. I know that lawmakers would be the first to say that this is the, you know, most they've ever spent on schools. And I see that from a numbers perspective. But I think there are folks concerned with why are we not bumping it up when we do have such a healthy financial outlook? And how can we get more so that we can see more progress being made?
Rachel, in about 10 seconds.
I'll go back to the alcohol laws. The amendment they passed for Rickers is just a Band-Aid.
And 10 seconds for you as well, John.
We still have a situation with property tax caps that needs to be continually addressed, and we didn't hear a lot about that this year.
I'd like to thank my guests, John Ketzenberger, Shana Cavazos, and Rachel Hoffmeyer, for what's been a lively conversation. And I also would like to remind our listeners that if you have not made your gift to WFYI yet, you should do so. Do what my wife and I have already done. You can do so by visiting the website, going to wfyi.org/give, or by calling 1-800-233-0020. Operators are ready to take your call. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations. We'll be right back.